Welcome to Sustain Now podcast. In this podcast, we are discussing the challenges and solutions to address the climate crisis by rethinking the value chain from designing, producing, and distributing goods to reach the ultimate goal, zero emissions. This podcast is hosted by Frederike. She is the co-founder of an e-commerce platform, active in different boards, and a tech lover. In this episode, she is talking with Christian Vollmann, a serial digital entrepreneur who transformed from a pure profit to an impact entrepreneur. He co-founded companies such as iLove, eDarling, video platform MyVideo, and social network Nebinan.de. Christian was Business Angel of the Year in 2017 and invested into more than 70 companies. In 2022, he co-founded Carbon One with the vision to replace fossil fuels-based methanol with green methanol for the shipping and chemical industry. Carbon One is building a platform to redesign the production process of methanol with quantum chemical simulation with the aim to save several gigatons of CO2 every year. In this episode, Christian Vollmann is sharing insights to his journey to becoming an impact entrepreneur, why it is so difficult to solve the climate crisis, why shipping industry is a good place to start, and how to be successful as a digital entrepreneur in the chemical industry.
Thank you so much for joining my podcast, Sustain Now. I'm really excited to have you as my guest.
How are you doing?
Good, very good, very good. I was very excited to have you on my podcast because I, as my, most of my listeners knows, I'm also sending a questionnaire beforehand to get to know my interview partners. And one answer of you strike me particularly interesting and sets the scene very nicely for our conversation. So the question is, what has been your biggest struggle in life? Your answer was turning from for-profit entrepreneur into impact entrepreneur. I thought it was a super interesting answer. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I basically started my professional career with an internship back in 99 in Berlin with a company called Alando, which became eBay Germany. And that really set me up for becoming a for-profit entrepreneur. I really wanted to get involved in the internet, the digitalization, and be a founder in that space. It was quite a challenge because when I finished my studies in 2002, the first internet bubble had burst and there was a big recession in Germany, very high unemployment in Berlin, and all the VCs had gone bankrupt. So it was quite hard to then actually become an internet entrepreneur. And when I finally had managed to do that after founding first iLove.de and then MyVideo.de and then eDarling, I basically had a crisis of purpose, I would say today. So I asked myself, okay, you're a for-profit entrepreneur now, but you know, founding one startup after the other, what for actually? And I had a crisis of purpose, and in the end, I came out of that crisis with the realization that I wanted to, you know, do something that has more impact. Back then, I was very worried about social cohesion in our society and the basis for our democracy. And my answer to that from an entrepreneurial perspective was to start a social neighborhood network platform called Nebenan.de, which today has almost 2.5 million members here in Germany, helping each other, sharing things. So it's a platform for neighborly help, and people get to know each other on a hyper-local level. And that really was my first impact venture. So that was my journey from a for-profit to an impact entrepreneur.
Super. Do you remember like one moment where you had this? Like I remember my moment when I changed, which was actually, I have to say, Greta in the end. Like I got angry about her, like all the messages, climate crisis and so on. And I said, like, okay, before I get angry, I actually need to understand it better. And I remember that I started, you know, to Googling and to go more into it. And I realized, oh God, I really don't have much clue about this climate crisis and what we're actually going to. And I really particularly remember that where I was sitting and I had this click moment. And for me, it was that moment of no return. Like from that moment, I had to go that route down more into diving into climate tech. Has been there a moment for you where you're like, this was there, you clicked and said like, oof, I really need to go another route than what I've done before?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is the moment when you reach a new level of consciousness in the end, right? When you actually realize your consciousness opens up and you realize something that you just haven't seen before. And for me, it's a two-step way. So first was really in 2015, struggling in that crisis of purpose, and then meeting with Till Behnke, who became my co-founder at nebenan.de, and really sharing my struggle with him, and Till basically saying, look, this, your idea of this neighborhood network, you have to do it. And that was really the moment when I realized, yeah, he's right. If I don't do it, then no one's going to do it, and it makes a difference. So that was the moment that made me become an impact entrepreneur. And then 7 years later, or like a year ago, there were multiple moments when I realized there is an even bigger problem I should be caring about, and that is climate change. And that was a combination of, so one thing was a talk by Fabian Heilemann, who basically said, you know, your kids and or our kids and our grandchildren are going to accuse us of knowing everything, having known everything, having all the information that's needed, and still not acting upon the problem. And they're going to accuse us like my generation in Germany did accuse their grandfathers of having fought in the Third Reich. And that really struck a chord with me, and that really changed my perspective. And what was a bit almost creepy was that my oldest son, who is now 11, basically almost at the same time started to really question, you know, Dad, you're an entrepreneur, so that means you're doing things. So what are you doing about this climate crisis we're having? Because I'm worried. And I didn't have a good answer. And that really was the moment that triggered my journey into that direction. And I totally agree with you, Frederike. It's a one-way street. There's no turning back.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of, for me, it was like being very critical. And I said, like, oh, there are always two sides and so on, to feel like being the missionary now, like really need to change. And what makes me really hopeful is that a lot of smart entrepreneurs and people are actually going into the climate tech space and really trying to find solutions. What kind of, do you think, like, what kind of skills you can bring, like, from a digital entrepreneur now into very climate tech chemical industry, which is very different? What do you feel like can you bring of kind of skills, or any other digital entrepreneur who's turning to impact can bring to the table and really help in the climate tech space?
Yeah, so we are, C1 is a green chemistry startup. So I like to give a picture from chemistry. I view myself as the catalyst to this invention and to the chemical team behind the invention, which means I cannot do the reaction myself, but I can help speed it up and make it smoother and enable the reaction. So which means, you know, having a commercial background, having founded four companies before, I see my role really as building the company, scaling the company, raising the necessary funds, recruiting the right people for the job, and basically setting the vision and communicating the vision to all stakeholders, be it potential employees, be it investors, be it the public, be it partners, politicians, etc. So this is really what I'm here for, and that's what I know how to do. And I always tell my team, mainly consisting of chemists and chemical engineers, you know, I tell them, you have to deliver what I promise. And that's really what
it is. It's good. It's good to have someone else delivering. I really like that. That's a good one. I think that's also the change what I've seen compared to, if you go back to, I've done some research. So how long do we actually know about the problem? And it's pretty scary. It's like from 1940, you have the first reports about that CO2 is actually bad for the atmosphere and it's going to heat up the whole planet. And there has been a lot of research the last 30, 40 years about it. And still the change is so limited over the last few years. But what makes me hopeful is that despite the clean tech one wave and now all the research we have, that in this wave, there's more alignment of government goals, investor goals, public opinion, and technical development. So that makes me kind of optimistic more that we're actually going to solve now a few of these problems. But what makes you in general optimistic that we will solve the climate crisis?
It's a very hard problem, right? And because we face multiple dilemmas, the dilemma of the commons, the dilemma of the long time horizons. It's plus we need global cooperation. It's very hard. But what makes me in general optimistic is, in the first place, it's a man-made problem. We've created this problem. So why shouldn't we be able to solve it? I think it can be done. And the other thing is that what makes me optimistic is the young generation. I see my kids, but also teenagers, being fully aware of the problem, pushing hard for solutions. The new generation really is, I think, very impact-driven, also in what they want to become and what companies they want to work for. They're going to drive change, and they're going to demand change, and they will be part of the change. So I think we still have a chance, and we need to remain stubbornly optimistic to get this done. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can't agree more. I think we need to have this optimistic. I really liked in the Bill Gates book that he said it's incredibly hard, but we have some technology baselines to actually achieve it if we put all our heads, money, and everything into it. So I agree on that, and I'm also hopeful with, you know, also with my daughter coming up now, and then hopefully that we can already put a baseline to that, that they can actually improve what we, you know, hopefully can improve in our lifetime as well. Coming like now, that's the hope. What do you see as the biggest challenge in solving the climate crisis, in your own words?
Well, it's the sheer scale of things. The fundamental underlying problem is that we are totally dependent on fossil resources for both our energy generation and as a basis for the products we make. And yeah, so we need to wean ourselves off this dependency that we have grown over 150 years in time. It has been the basis of our wealth, and makes it very, very hard, because we don't want to make the poorest people pay the bill. We don't want third world countries pay the bill. We need everyone on board. Global cooperation is needed. And yeah, it's a very, very complex problem. But I think in the end, we need to lead the way and show the world how it can be done. And I think Germany and Europe can really play a leading role here, because I think we are ahead in terms of our consciousness of the problem. And we have the science and the engineering that's needed. And if we now get better at commercializing and scaling those technologies, you know, more interdisciplinary teams of experienced founders with great scientists and engineers, I think we can play a leading role. And that in itself is also an opportunity. You know, every risk is also an opportunity. There's opportunity in every crisis. So yeah, I think that's the way we need to see it.
Based on your words, would you say, you know, the digitalization, you can say it was primarily driven more in the US, like by the, you know, Silicon Valley and so on. Would you say that the climate tech the sustainability revolution, I call it, can be driven more by Europe, because you think it's more the engineering and so on? Do you think that could be, you know, as well, like a leading part, that Europe can take a bigger part in that?
Yes, I definitely think so. I've just been to the US for the first time in 3 years since the corona crisis hit. And I have to say, I was quite shocked. I think the US is years behind in consciousness about the problem. I've met a climate tech fund, West Coast Silicon Valley based climate tech fund. And then I talked to them, and it turns out that 66% of their LP base, in terms of volume, in terms of US dollar volume, is European. And most of them European, successful European unicorn founders. So, you know, and that tells a lot, because, I think we are years ahead in terms of having realized that this is currently the biggest problem. But also, we are in a very good position. We still have amongst the world's best chemists. You know, we are very good with our Fraunhofer, Helmholtz, etc. Scientific institutions, very good in basic science. We just need to get better in, you know, commercializing that and really turning it into scalable companies that actually scale the impact. But I think this is going to be the next phase of the next evolution phase of the European startup ecosystem. We're going to see more and more founders going into this direction.
Interesting that you say that, you know, Germany or Europe can play a bigger role. I also see that point. What I'm seeing right now lacking is more the ability to allocate really growth money, like growth investment, and not only like in the equity part. What I don't know, I would like to see your point of view that I think debt financing is still very underrepresented, especially if you want to do plans and stuff like that, which is usually more hardware heavy. How do you see that? Like, what? How do you see the allocation of money right now to the problem? Is that enough right now in Europe? Is there a big gap? And how can we close that gap?
No, it's not nearly enough. There's still much more money going into oil and gas exploration than into green tech, right? So if we want to wean ourselves off the dependency, that's of course has to change. And so we need a lot more money deployed into this direction. Again, it's currently a problem, but it's also an opportunity. I think Europe could not only build the companies and the tech to solve this, but we could also build the green capital market. And, you know, we currently, the US is the dominating capital market in the world. And here we have an opportunity to actually build a new capital market that is focused on green investments and become the leading place for that type of financing.
Okay.
If we seize it, we could do it.
Yeah. So coming now to Carbon One. The vision of the company, you wrote me, is establish closed carbon cycles in shipping and chemical production via green methanol. Can you explain that vision and how you want to achieve it?
Yeah, so very briefly, I've teamed up with scientists who over the last 14 years have developed a quantum mechanical simulation platform for chemistry. So they've been computer simulating chemical reactions and have become very, very good at this. So they understand on the molecular level how reactions take place and can invent new catalysts, for example. That's what they've done. And our new production technology for methanol is just the first product that we commercialize out of this underlying technology platform. That is something that you have to understand. Now, this new method is really disruptive to the current methanol production process. So we're taking it from a heterogeneous catalysis to a homogeneous catalysis. And that solves a lot of the fundamental problems of the existing process, making it more efficient in the use of the feedstock and making it more scalable and more flexible. And that basically opens up the possibility to start thinking about producing methanol not from a fossil source as we do today. So the 100 million tons of methanol that are currently produced are 100% from either gas or coal, so from a fossil source. And they're being used as either fuel or input for the chemical industry. And it's a linear consumption model, so it's a fossil feedstock. With our technology, we can produce methanol not from a fossil source, but from a biogenic carbon source. So, for example, waste biomass, and in the long run, even from CO2. So it's in the long run, we want to repurpose CO2 into green methanol. And green methanol holds the key to defossilize both the container shipping industry and carbon-based chemical production. So the chemical industry can produce anything that's carbon-based that it today produces from mainly oil or gas, from methanol. We're talking about plastics, paints, adhesives, and a lot of other products that we could then produce from a biogenic carbon source. And by doing that, we're really driving the carbon in circles instead of taking it out of the ground and it ends up as CO2 in the atmosphere.
Okay, just to reframe it, like maybe in my own words, and please correct me. First, it's extremely crazy where fossil fuel is the base. I just learned that 98% of all truffle oils, so when you use truffle oil, that is aromatic, what is in there, it's 98% is based on fossil fuel. So it's not actually, you know, truffle. So that made me really understand how wide the chemical industry is actually using fossil fuels into all the products we have. So that's why I think, as I totally agree, the challenge to get fossil fuels out of our system is extremely big. But to understand the process a little bit better, what has been used so far, so you use fossil fuels, which is gas and oil, you have a catalyst in the middle, and then you're actually getting methanol out of that. And instead of using fossil fuels, you take biomass, which is, could be soy, or which could be any other from old tree, like trees, parts of the trees, etc., as the base to create via a different catalyst model green methanol out of that. Is that kind of
exactly understood? So okay. It's from a chemical point of view, it's exactly the same thing as fossil. It's only the source of the carbon molecule. Methanol contains one carbon molecule. That's why company name is C1. Mm-hmm. And the only difference is the source of that one carbon molecule. In our case, it comes from waste biomass. And that's important. It needs to be waste biomass. We don't want to plant soy or to cut down trees to produce green methanol. That would not help. But we're talking about waste biomass. So it's wood waste. It's we can use sewage. We can use black liquor, which is a waste product in the paper making industry. So all kinds of waste products that have a biogenic carbon molecule contained. Mm-hmm. And we can use tap into all kinds of those waste products. And then it's really green methanol that we produce.
Okay, understand. And to get a little bit perspective on the volumes you actually need, I was researching, please correct me again if it's wrong, but I read that a container ship, which is right now, I think you're primarily, you're targeting right now in the first step, container ships has needs around 63,000 gallons of marine fuel per day at a normal speed. I calculated that it's like 290,000 liters. And a normal car uses 4,000 liters per day. So that would mean that the container ship uses the amount of a yearly fuel of 70 cars per day. That's like intense from the volume. So how much actually you need to put in front in, like how much biomass, how much CO2 in the end, but let's say biomass to create like 63,000 gallons of green methanol fuel. What's the scale? So just to get a perspective on what we're talking about, what you need to achieve in terms of volumes to get a fuel in one day.
Earlier, I told you that the main problem is the scale, right? Yeah. So here's an example. So Maersk, as the biggest container shipping company, just ordered 12 container ships that are going to run on green methanol, sending a strong advanced buying signal into the market that they're doing a great job there. The first one is going to be ready to go into service in Q1 2024. And per ship, each of these 12 ships needs 40,000 tons of green methanol per year. So once the 12 are in operation, they're going to need roughly 500,000 tons of green methanol per year. And that is only those 12 ships. Those 12 ships, I think, are going to be around 0.5% of the total container ship fleet in the world. And we did the calculation. If the shipping industry, today's shipping industry, would switch 100% to green methanol, they would need around 500 million tons of green methanol per year. Now, I told you the current yearly production of methanol, fossil, is 100 million tons. So which means the market would go from 100 to 600 million tons. So the market would go times six. And that's shipping only. That's not including chemical production. So that's where you get a sense of the quantities and the scale. It is very, very big. And now waste biomass sources are not going to get us all the way there. That's for sure. So the good thing is waste biomass, the technology is there. We can start, and there's quite some potential left there. There's quite a lot of waste biomass we're actually not using. So it's enough to scale for the first 10 years, roughly. But then at one point we need to switch to a different source, and that is the second route I already told you about. That's really repurposing CO2. So the second route we can produce green methanol from is taking CO2 and green hydrogen and producing green methanol that way. And we can, there you can, to make it green, also according to EU regulation, the latest EU regulation, you can either use CO2 from unavoidable point sources. So they need to be unavoidable. So you could not use CO2 from a coal power plant, for example, because the electricity could have produced green in a different way. So it's not an unavoidable source. But if you use CO2 from a cement production, that today we don't have an alternative for. So that's an unavoidable CO2 source. You can use that and you get green methanol. Or in the long run, and that's, of course, the big hope we all have, you can repurpose the CO2 that comes out of direct air capturing technologies. Instead of, you know, storing it away somewhere, hoping that it doesn't leak, you can actually use it as an input and repurpose it. And then you've created a giant carbon cycle. And we're really talking about circular economy because you're driving ships and you're building chemical products. And as you said, oil and gas is everywhere. It's in your lipstick. It's everywhere, right? It's in your sun cream and it's in almost all the products around you. It's even in furniture, because if you, at least if it's IKEA, you know, that even contains today. It's really everywhere. And yeah, if you could take it out of the air, right, the air capture, and then built it back into the fuels and the products, and you're really driving it in circles.
So we hope that Climeworks just got tons of money, that it will scale up as they promised, as well as some others, to really get the CO2 out of the
exactly
air.
And that would really also help them, because we could actually be an uptaker for that CO2, and we could actually pay a price
just only storage
for that, right? And they would have a business model. That's the hope we have.
So it seems like you've done an extensive life cycle analysis, what I think is very important in all the things we're doing, that we're actually taking account all the right boundaries of a life cycle analysis. What has been the biggest challenge, if you look at this life cycle analysis in the production, like in the whole site? What's the biggest challenge really to get the CO2 out of it, or in general to maintain a positive net zero, what where you want to go to? What has been the biggest challenge in developing that and in the whole process?
Well, it's a complex problem, and you really want to compare, have a like for like comparison, and that's not always that easy. So we were lucky that our lead investor, Planet A, did a thorough life cycle analysis, and they have a great team of LCA scientists on board. So together we worked on this, and yeah, the outcome is that we're reducing CO2 about 76% to 80% compared to the status quo with our green methanol technology. And yeah, that makes me really hopeful that we can actually have a big impact. But again, right, we need to scale the technology to also be able to realize that impact. And that's really what we're working on right now.
So why not electrify a container ship or use hydrogen? You probably get that question a lot.
Yeah, so. So basically, when you look at the big picture, right, we should be electrifying everything that can be directly electrified, because the efficiency of an electric engine is around 92% versus 23% for a combustion engine. So everything that can be directly electrified should be electrified. That's why we're going in the direction of electric cars. That's why we're going into electric heat pumps to heat our homes. That makes a lot of sense. The problem is that you're left with some industries that cannot be electrified, at least not with current battery technology. You have aviation, where planes just get too heavy with batteries. They won't be able to take off. So in aviation, electrification is not the solution, at least not for long haul flights, for short haul maybe. And then also in container shipping, electrification is not the solution. The ship, the batteries would be so big and the ship would be so heavy that it couldn't take any cargo. So you have to look at other things, other alternatives. And then there's also, like, in cement, we have to look for other solutions. Steel production, aluminium, glass production, we have to look for other solutions. And the answer is it depends, and there's going to be a difference for, like, each sector will have its own solution. You know, in steel, it's very likely to be green hydrogen. In shipping at the moment, the shipping industry starts with green methanol. I'm not saying that it will only be green methanol in shipping. They are also looking into hydrogen or green ammonia. It's just that the risk to switch from today's liquid fuel to a fuel that is a gas is much more difficult and much more risky. And also technology readiness levels for green ammonia and green hydrogen in shipping are not there yet. They are actually on the engine and vessel level. They are at around 3. That's far too immature to start rolling it out. You need to be at least at 7, if not 8, technology readiness level to start rolling out. And green methanol is at 8 or even 9 at all the important points. Another thing is that the engines are cheaper, and also the whole infrastructure can be used. So the bunkering infrastructure, pipelines, trucks, ships to transport the stuff and to have it in the harbor ready and bunkered is compatible with today's technology. So you don't have to change all that if you go to a liquid, which is methanol.
So what's the switching?
One last thing is the 12 ships they've ordered now, and that's also a smart move. They can run on both ship diesel and methanol. So that also makes it, of course, and that's also wouldn't work with ammonia or hydrogen. So, you know, you can go from Copenhagen into the world with green methanol. And if it's not available at your destination yet, you can come back with diesel and you at least defossilized half of your journey, right? Better than nothing. And we have to start somewhere. And it's the problem is we're running so often into chicken and egg problems and that keep us from actually starting, right? And that's also what they solved so nicely with by sending this signal of ordering those ships, because it's before there was really the problem. There was no demand, hence no supply. But no supply means no demand could develop. So, you know, and they are really breaking that chicken egg problem now and doing a great job there.
Great. I think I really like that example because, for example, hydrogen, I looked at small container ships like going between islands, you know, transporting their containers between islands. But there the key problem is that on the small islands, there's no one can actually fill up hydrogen. So they're struggling with the infrastructure around it. So you can have a great idea, but if you don't have the infrastructure around it to actually execute it, it will be very difficult to scale. So I like that. I didn't know that you can switch a kind of a hybrid model between diesel and green methanol. How much does it cost to convert such old container ships into green methanol?
So currently what they're doing is they're ordering the new ships as green methanol ships or dual use ships. They cost around 15% more than the conventional ships. So there is a green premium, but it's only 15%, which is manageable. And it will come down as more people order those ships, right? And the technology matures, this green premium will become smaller and eventually, I think, go away because it's fundamentally not that different, the technology between a diesel engine and a dual-use engine. And retrofitting is, of course, then the next step. And there, I think they're really faced with the shipping industry is really faced with a choice, because they actually, what you have to understand is they have two emission problems. They not only have the CO2 emission problem, they also have, SOx, NOx, particulate matter emission problem. It's not, very healthy what they emit today. And EU regulation is tightening around SOx, NOx. So they are now faced with, okay, do we invest in quite expensive filtering technology, retrofitting our ships, but solving only the one of those two problems, or do we take a bolder step, switch to green methanol, and solve both emission problems? And I think, you know, the answer, I think, is pretty obvious. So I expect also quite some retrofitting happening. But, of course, the supply has to develop, right? It doesn't help them to retrofit and then they cannot source and procure the necessary amount of green methanol. So they're at the moment, I think, watching that space quite anxiously, whether the supply is actually developing. And the problem on that side is that all the companies that are now rushing into producing green methanol are based on the old heterogeneous methanol catalysis that's 100 years old. So the first plant was built by BASF in 1923. So next year it's 100 years old and it's totally out optimized. You know, there's companies are happy if they get a 0.1% of improvement somewhere is a big thing because it's out optimized. It's end of. So we need something better.
So when do you think you will have a scalable market product?
Yeah, I wish sooner than later, but it's a reality and current supply chains are not helping, to be quite honest. You have to go through a technology development process. So basically what we are at technology readiness level 5 at the moment. Now we've ordered our first own mini plant that we're going to run in our own facilities with gas from a bottle. So that's going to take us to 6. We're going to prove a continuous chemical production process with that. Then we are going to do our first pilot projects in chemical parks using real green feedstocks, producing green methanol under real conditions. That is technology readiness level 7. Real conditions, but still very small quantities. It's about demonstrating that it works in a pilot. And then the next step is to do the first demo plant. And that is about scale, right? So the demo, what you want to show in the demo is that it scales and that you can do it 1,000 times bigger or even 10,000 times bigger. The good news is in homogeneous catalysis, and we have quite some chemical experts on our board with Jürgen Hambrecht from BASF and others. And we've also talked to quite a lot of experts, and they've confirmed that with a homogeneous catalysis, since we're talking about a liquid reactor, we're dissolving the gas in the liquid, and our catalyst is also dissolved in the same liquid, and the reaction takes place within the liquid. And that scales much, much better than a heterogeneous catalysis. So there is documented that scale-up factors of up to 10,000 from one reactor to the next generation is possible. And that makes me hopeful that once we've shown in pilot that it works, we will be able to scale up quite fast. But to answer your question shortly, it will take 3 years until we can produce relevant quantities of green methanol.
Can you actually refit existing plants? So if you go to BASF or other chemical producers and say, okay, you're doing it the old way, can you refit them and say, now we just put one, you know, block into it and then you can...
We could, but then we would make fossil methanol production more efficient, and we don't want to do that. We want to, you know, we want to switch to green feedstocks. Otherwise, it's not green methanol that comes.
Can you put there the input? That's not possible. So you have to have a total different plant because the whole process is different.
Yes. So basically, the input into our process is the same from a chemical perspective. So the input is something that is called synthesis gas, or short syngas. And syngas is a mixture of CO, carbon monoxide, and hydrogen, H2. So it's COH2. And we have the same feedstock. So we also need that syngas. Mm-hmm. But now the question again is, how is that syngas produced? Mm-hmm. And today it's produced from methane, so from gas, fossil gas, or in China from coal, which is even dirtier. And that needs to be switched to a green source. And so retrofitting the current production would not help. We could make quite a lot of money doing that, but it's a conscious decision to say, no, we're not doing that.
Okay.
Because it's going to prolong the life of fossil methanol production.
When I hear you, it's very impressive how, you know, how much knowledge you gathered in that short time about that whole process. So in general, how do you continue to learn in order to stay top of things within your, you know, what you're doing? Like what kind of method you're using that you can stay top of your mind in these things?
The answer is be brutally honest with yourself and be not afraid of asking, right? So whenever I'm in a meeting with my team and they're talking about something I don't have a clue about, I say, look, you've just lost me. Please explain. I don't understand. So it takes quite a lot of their time. But so far they've been very patient. So I really have to say I have an awesome team, right? So there's the inventor of the whole thing is Marek Czyczynski, who is not only one of the best catalyst scientists in the world, but also really a computer nerd running his own data centers. When you go there, you think it's Bitcoin mining, but it's actually simulation of chemistry on huge computer farms. Then there's Ralf Krenert, who is the chemical engineer, whose father used to run the chemical park in Leuna in East Germany. So already 4 years, he went with his father there and saw the production, and ever since wanted to become a chemical engineer. And then there's Christoph Zehe, who is also a chemist by education, but has an industry and consultancy background. So he's really the link between technology and economics. So he's the best I know in techno-economic modeling, because you have to understand there is lots of ideas out there, and they all work in theory, and it's really hard to find out whether they make economic sense, because there's so many ideas, and that's also what makes it so hard. You know, a lot is theoretically possible, but the question is, will it ever make economic sense? And how to get there? And that's what he is really good about. So strategy and business development. So I'm really happy to have that team on board. We're now hiring. So we have lots of open positions, especially for chemists. We would love to do the first female hire. So I really encourage every female chemist out there, every female chemical engineer out there, please apply. We do not want to build a boys club here. And yeah, so that's what we are currently struggling with.
Fantastic. Great. I will definitely put that on in the blog as well. So I think that's great that you're explicitly searching as well for that. I think what I just learned is that for you, you know, maintaining that network of people you know and you trust and just continuously asking. I think I read somewhere that you also, one of the key success you see is general communication. And I read somewhere that you're writing every month to your investors. Are you still doing that?
Yes, I'm. So I've for the time being switched to quarterly reportings, just because in an internet startup, it's a bit more dynamic. You know how it is. If you have an idea, you run an A/B test and you know, 2 weeks later, the feature is live. So you have weekly sprints. So there's more to report. Unfortunately, you know, here we're talking about building a chemical reactor. You cannot do A/B testing or build it in a 1 week sprint. I wish you could, but it's not possible. And at least I haven't found a way how to do it yet. Still looking for it. So, you know, it's at the moment, it's very clear what we have to do. So I'm still doing it, but on a quarterly basis. But again, it goes out to all my investors. So the biggest lead investor down to the smallest angel investor get the same reporting, and it goes to all employees. So full transparency. And I've fared well with that strategy. I think it's a great strategy.
Can you share? You don't have to share what's in that, but more the sharing. Like, do you have a structure you always follow? Like, these are the three points you always cover.
So with C1, we've divided it into the three major work streams, which are chemistry, so developing the catalyst further, and how to source the catalyst, how to produce the catalyst, how to recycle it, etc. So the chemical work stream, the engineering work stream is the second one, building the mini plant, building the pilot, and then really like business development. So, you know, deciding which pilot should we do, what do we want to prove in the pilot, where should the pilot be, which partners, etc. So those are the big three work streams, and I have each of my founders report for their work stream, and then I give a bit more on the one level higher, the strategy level, sharing news, also sharing failures or reporting about challenges, where we ran into challenges, and then really asking for help. So saying these three points we would currently need help with, It can be hiring. Do you know a CFO, or it can be we would need an intro to this company, or we're currently faced with this strategic decision. So basically asking your investors for help. And what has proven quite effective is that if you then receive help based on your request, to actually shout it out in the next reporting. So say, thank you very much to whoever it was for sharing this great CFO candidate with me. Because that really motivates people to think about, hey, this person helped. Maybe I can think harder about how I can help. So it gets your investors going.
Very nice. Thank you so much. So I learned a lot. I learned from your journey, from what Carbon One is doing, and also your skills, which you can bring to climate tech. It has been a very inspiring talk for me. How can people contact you? If, for example, now a female chemist would like to say, hey, I really would like to apply for that job, what's the best way of contacting you or the company?
So all our jobs are on the website, which is carbon.one. You can write me an email at christian@carbon.one. You can contact me via LinkedIn. So I'm really open on all channels. Happy to be contacted anytime.
Fantastic. So thank you so much for joining my podcast Sustain Now. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much, Friederike. I did likewise.
Thank you for joining today's episode. You can find the show notes, background materials, and contact details of our guests on our website, sustainnow.ch. Follow and share our podcast on any platform available. Do you have a comment or interesting solution to take a deep dive? Please don't hesitate to go to our website, sustainnow.ch, and write us an email.